Tonight the talk is called Desire or Aspiration. So a number of myths, you can say, circulate around this notion of desire. And there's no doubt that the common one is that often we have an understanding of a certain type of desire and think that we shouldn't have it, and if a mature spiritual person is a seeker, there shouldn't be any type of desires. Another is thought or belief is that the Buddha taught that all desires are causes for suffering and therefore they should be eliminated. But actually, very clear, specific type of desire, which is a cause of suffering. And there's no doubt that life without desire is not necessarily a good thing. In a way, even one sees in Western psychology that one symptom, you can say, of depression is to have no desires, right? So some clarification is offered tonight. The Buddha did not teach that all types of desire was the cause for suffering. And in fact, in the Satipatthana Sutta, which is the manual for meditation, he even spoke of a certain type of ardent desire for liberation. So, no small thing if it's ardent. And he definitely is an example of having really both in a very ardent desire for liberation to be able to realize it. So I think it's important to just differentiate and distinct healthy from unhealthy desire. And why does the confusion come up is certainly because we use the same word for two very different types of manifestations. And so, the type that Simi talked about a few nights ago is definitely the one that is the cause of suffering. Suffering, desire, which is definitely present and is a kind of craving. So this in the teachings is called tanha. And actually, the literal translation for tanha is thirst, or hunger. There's no end. You know, you can be thirsty and we can sense that you can drink and then you need to drink more and more and more. So this thirst has no end. And so it's a very nice way to put it, actually. But the healthy type of desire is called chanda. And that's kind of a literal translation of that word is aspiration. And definitely, it will contribute to our sense of well-being and drive us to a greater sense of happiness in our lives, right? And hopefully some. So if we place healthy and unhealthy or wholesome and unwholesome desire, because I'm going to be using the same word, on a spectrum, right? At one end, we have all the motivations that we have in our lives and that lead towards some fulfillment. I think that we wouldn't be here, for sure, if there wasn't the sense of drive, of aspiration. And on the other spectrum, the kind of unwholesome desire, which of course leads some actions to express themselves in a very unhealthy way. And the example that's often used is, it's a well-known example, that one can be holding a knife in one's hand, right? And out of that sense of motivation, use it to heal someone or to harm someone. Depending on the motivation, the action can lead to a very different result that we'll understand. So on one side, you can say that there's craving, I'm going to distinct now these two words, craving, which is the type of desire that Simi spoke about two evenings ago. And on the other side is the healthy desire, which I'm going to be calling aspiration. So now, the sense of desire, which is leading to suffering, which is called craving, is often accompanied by contraction, tension, and pressure. And there's no doubt that we've been feeling the actual experience of this. And in a way, we are in this very situation so that we're enabling to notice it, to know how it functions itself out. This type of craving usually leads to clinging, meaning that's how we, from this sense of thirst, we are then fueled by attachment, which she talked about. Charles spoke of very clearly about this sense of greed, right? Clinging in one way or another to anything, and on the other sense, on the other level, is aversion or rejection, wanting, not wanting, in a way. So craving actually has a very high cost, because today probably we would use the word addiction. We have the sense, I mean, you know, in our world today, there's no doubt that we understand, and it's a common field of experience where, whether you are in psychology or even philosophy, there's a really very great interest, even in medicine, in relationship to this type of addiction. So many types of addictions are happening nowadays, right? So when craving has the lead, it's exactly here that what she spoke of the other night is we are compulsively reacting and constantly reacting out of patterns which have a very high cost and which often lead us to make very poor choices. And mostly we're not having a choice in those moments, right? Because we're driven by these reactive patterns. And so it can take a hold of our bodies when it's expressed as physical tension, and usually there are holding patterns that can come become quite big, actually, in relationship to feeling some contraction. And these holdings are definitely the ways that we create, as Charles spoke of, how do we create our own tension? Tension is not just here by chance, right? It's how do we relate in a way that tension builds up. And so in our practice, we can sense that this force of wanting can be extremely exhausting. And very clearly, I'm sure that for many of us, before coming to a retreat like this, we're not really noticing this force at work. So unnoticed, craving can very clearly lead also to the sense of disconnection from our being. Unfulfilled craving can all too easily also turn into frustration and anger. So there's no doubt that this leads to suffering if it's not seen for what it is. If it's not understood, felt, and discovered by the pathway of mindfulness and wisdom, there's no doubt that so much of the time the mind is, just to have a sense that it's probably not after a 5-day retreat like this one that this force is just going to be gently going out the window. There's no doubt that it's going to take a little more practice, I can assure you. There's a very nice little story, actually, about the Dalai Lama a few years ago going every day from his hotel to a conference room, conference place where the conference was held. And this was an American city. I can't remember if it was New York or Boston. And every morning he was passing a series of shops that were selling new technology appliances. Of course. And he said that the first day he laughingly said that his mind was desiring one of them. And that it was really going out. But he was seeing, of course, Dai Lama. But by the end of the week, he wanted all of them. And the most funny thing is that he didn't even know what they were. That's exactly what happens for all of us, isn't it? So this is the strength, the force of craving, wanting, wanting, wanting. And I'm sure you've been seeing this operate. We're in this very situation, steeped in to see it over and over and over again, the force of desire. So this thirst is the primary reason the mind chases after its own thoughts. It is kind of the root for this swirling of thought making. And an important part of this meditation practice, the way that we are sitting, the way that we're focusing, the way that we're walking with mindfulness, really steady a little bit ourselves and discover the other end of the spectrum, which may be in connection with the being, a deeper of motivation, which is very different. Also had this type of experience. I know a few of you came with a very decision-making need in relationship to life. This hasn't maybe from that place of presence, there was something to discover from a new place. So when the superficial chatter, thoughts, right, comes down a little bit, among the most beautiful things that we can find is our sense of aspiration, sense of greater value. And the sensitivity and awareness that comes from this practice supports the taste in aspirations. Because life is life, and it's full of surprises. So not only here do we get in touch with the present moment, but we also get in touch, I'm sure, for some of us, we may discover this, yet to come, with our sense of aspiration. And we can also sense very clearly how the aspiration can turn into craving. And we can notice this from that place of direct experience. And that's part of the practice, to notice them. How the aspiration suddenly comes into wanting. And one of the ways that I've been really noticing this very clearly is in the metta practice, where you really are in this mode of caring, of well-being, and having the aspiration to wish well, to wish another person well, and then suddenly there's a wanting, a demand, something which is a little bit more tense and struggle, even wanting to feel more care for the other person. Already there, there's a slight movement that's tensing up, and it's just not anymore this kind of settled and really gentle wave of kindness that manifests. So we can see, and it's in our practice, we're going to be noticing one movement from one to the other. So how to notice craving in our practice? Usually with physical and mental tension. That's what's present, full of aspiration. And therefore there's some uneasiness, some discomfort, and a lot of restlessness at times, or agitation, impatience. All of that comes from that source of craving. Mentally, it also comes. How? And I'm sure that we've had a sense of purpose, to come here. And so the sense of purpose, kind of the sense of why am I here, right, is important. It's an aspiration. But then what happens is that we're expecting something from the practice, right? And so the aspiration turns mentally into the craving. How? Through expectation, wanting, a demand. At its best, aspiration has an openness to possibility without a need for anything to happen from this place of wanting. Understand this? It's quite extraordinary. Now, it doesn't mean that we don't act on our aspirations. It's not saying that the meditation is saying, oh, just be passive or resign. Not at all. We act on our aspirations. Don't cling to their success. Exactly where exactly, and I'm going to be explaining it this a little. We discover what is the base of our life, what is the wish that we have to, what is it that we're putting forward, the energy that is engaged, all of that is fully present, actually, very active, very, that we're developing. Mindfulness, wisdom, patience, equanimity, generosity of heart, compassion, loving kindness, all of these qualities nourish the aspiration so that we move in a direction that is wished. The Buddha's teachings. And this is the core teaching, the first teaching actually that the Buddha offered. All of the Four Noble Truths, but actually just a link to what I'm going to be saying next. First Noble Truth is the truth is a freedom from craving. Meaning freedom from suffering, grasping, or greed, hatred, and delusion. The fourth noble truth is there's a path, the path that we're walking. A path, there's a sense of path. It's not just only being, there is a sense of path. And it's called the Eightfold Path. It means that there are eight parts. One part is very clearly a foundation of wholesome action, which means the way we behave and live in our life, right? Wise action, wise livelihood, wise speech, in relationship to other beings, right? That's called meditation, which we've been applying very intensely here. Wise effort, wise mind. Meditation part, cultivation of meditation. And then the third part is the wisdom, which is wise understanding and wise intention. Understanding or wisdom. So there's a foundation of very clear conduct, which definitely is born in an aspiration will be healthy conduct. And then there's the meditation, and then we can sense that there's which manifests, emerges. No doubt that the second fold, wisdom part, wise intention, is manifesting as a way of intention in relationship to our aspiration. And what the Buddha talked about here is, in the best way possible, if there's an aspiration, we are working in a way that we are trying to not cause harm to ourselves, meaning that we treat ourselves and others very clearly, manifesting in the Buddha's teachings. Okay, there's the wisdom wing and there's the compassion wing, and they both come together for a fulfilling life, right? So that we can have a sense of happiness. Now, in choosing to live with wise intention, it doesn't mean at all that we're giving up our desires for achieving. And hopefully, I think, and I wish for you that you achieve many beautiful for a better life. So, there's a way that we understand that we're motivated and we're committing to living each moment with the intention of cultivating this wise intention, you can say, what serves us? And then to connect this quality, you can say, of sense of integrity, and then definitely live from that place as best we can. There's no doubt. So standing from this ground of intention, then we are participating in life, and we're trying to choose from that space of aspiration. So in our lives, naturally, sometimes things go very well, right, the way we like them to go, and sometimes they don't. Or the opposite direction. So we can sense that with an aspiration, there's still a possibility of openness to receive the endless fluctuations. And that's kind of the mindfulness with the wisdom that allows that. How does this happen? It happens from our sense in our internal experience and balance, be able to receive life as it comes. And this is equated to what Simi, in her last words, in relationship to equanimity. I'm really one of these happy and blessed, I can say, human beings who know a bit better who they are and the way that they wish to live their lives. And therefore, the choices that are made are coming a little bit more from connection and a sense of, oh, this is what I'd like to choose. And it's quite extraordinary because quite a number of you have actually expressed this. I know what I wanted, my mind didn't know where it was, and it seems like just incredible way. Quite a number of people came to me and say, now I know. I'm much more clear in relationship to my sense of intention and a sense of aspiration. When you think of it, it's 4 days. It's extraordinary. Why? Because we're connecting and connecting and connecting. And so we're less busy, and so we can sense this deeper connection, which allows us to see more clearly about from conversation with a meditator I had on a retreat, and she said, I must be confused about the Buddha's teaching on right intention. I'm very good about setting intentions and then reminding myself of them, but things don't ever seem to turn out according to those intentions. I fall into disappointment. What were the intentions? First of all, she described a number of goals for her future, which were to become less tense at work, to have a kinder attitude with one of her family members, to sleep more, to spend more time meditating. I mean, very wholesome intentions, actually. She was confused, probably, a lot of the time, and we clarified this together, right? Mixing the two ways that are very easily mistaken, one for the other. And that's setting intention or goal making, which is very different. And that's how I expressed it to her, actually. Now, goal making is very present nowadays. Goal making is totally based in the future, right? All based in the outcome. And it's a valuable skill, there's no doubt, right? It pertains to worldly life, right? If we are aspiring to something and we're taking action, there's a wanting of the goal, isn't it? Right? Except it often involves this. It involves envisioning a future outcome in the world or in our behavior. And therefore, then, we're planning, applying, and working hard to achieve this goal. And we lose connection most of the time with the deeper sense of all of our time and energy is organized in relationship to fulfilling the call. Or you can relate to this here also in Israel. Maybe you're special, but when I was talking to this yogi, she was not in Israel, and probably human condition is the same. So you may relate to this. If you don't, good for you. So they help provide direction to our life. Yes, we commit and we can visualize our goal. They may help us in our efforts. They may help us in nourishing the energy that's needed, right? But neither of these activities is what we call setting intention. Why? Because with goals, the future is always the focus. Hence, when we're constantly out there trying to fulfill our goal, I'm going to ask questions. The thought is, am I going to be reaching that goal? And then maybe there's worry. Will I only be happy when I reach the goal? What if I don't reach the goal? Right? So what happened? Hope and fear. Hope and fear. Expectation and fear. Hope and fear. These two dimensions are not peaceful qualities. Right? So in our meditation, I've had many questions asked, like, okay, what's next? You know, I've heard many of you say, okay, I'm present, huh? And now, what's next? Right? With a kind of impatience to jump out of our skin, to move ahead, the craving, this force. So we know it so well. I mean, it's so clearly manifesting. It all happens. The Dalai Lama wanting the thing. So setting intention is quite different than only goal making. Why? Because it is not oriented in a way that we're attached to the outcome. And it's huge. It's huge. The difference is huge. It does not at all mean that we are not living a life with plenty of dreams. Instead, in this path of practice that's focused, say, on being rather than becoming, the present moment is the source. We choose to move in a direction. So the attention, and I think that's so helpful to understand, the attention that we are cultivating moment by moment is on the ever-present now. And we've said this many, many times. But it's so difficult to hear because we want the result, right? But this attention is based, grounded on the ever-present now, in the constantly changing flow of life. What matters the most is that we can make a commitment to connect or align our inner values. And this is what we're going to be going home with. Hopefully, knowing a little bit more deeply what we sense, what we wish for ourselves. And when I talked exactly about this to a lady today, it would be gold. And it is. And I said, yes, it's precious to have this sense of connection where we can really allow ourselves to feel the connection in the present moment, live from that space, and this is exactly what practice brings and allows, and grow in insight and grow in understanding with some wise reflection, of course, realize then our life from this space. An ever-renewing process. That's what's so extraordinarily manifesting. We don't just forget our intentions. And we set our intentions and then we forget about them, right? Okay, and then we go on our life and goal achieving. So we live these intentions every day as our life. And so with this meditator, I mean, we had quite a long time together, just focusing on her inner experience of the present moment and seeing exactly how this change to focusing on wanting and then visualizing the future outcome. And this is the process. She realized it so clearly. And what did she mean? She said, well, it's all about attitude. Nothing to do with getting and not getting. It's about my attitude. And it was so great for me to witness her understanding this. It was just so, you know, sometimes when you meditators really get it, understand, wow, this is exactly what's happened with joy. So she was really noticing that as soon as her state of mind was in wanting, craving, it's destabilized her. And to see the craving, to see the actual loop of tension caused by being attached to the outcome with mindfulness could very clearly bring herself back into hand. There was a vanishing of that desire and a feeling of aspiration. And all of you, I'm sure, can understand this. And at times, she would come and she made so much effort, but it didn't go anywhere. And then she was disappointed and confused. And that's also part of the process. That at times we clearly lose track of the path because we lose track of our attitude and we're kind of grounded in a way. And so to regain mental balance when this happens in mindfulness, trust in awareness that helps. With this we learn to make choices and then we can work very hard at, even if there are very big emotional story. The preciousness of this practice offers really a new, and not only on retreat, clearly a very intense situation, and there's no doubt, yet if we can sense the value, remember that it can be carried intentions. The very clear question, which I think opening, and it is the opening, and it is the kind of the offering of the Buddha's teaching. In measure the success of your life, would it be like? And this is exactly what we began the retreat with. Not miss on our life. Connected so that we realize our deeper values. And we speak of this in a spiritual context. But there's no doubt that it can be spoken of in some other context. Because we are losing ourselves in Rinpa, the great Tibetan master called, and it has a great payoff. It realizes. There's no doubt. Otherwise you wouldn't be sitting here in this room for 4 or 5 days. Remember that the value, the deepest value, is appreciating what's living our own experience. Goals will never fulfill us in an ongoing way. It's not about, because they often call for another goal and another goal. And it's the kind of endless thing. Realize, live from that space of intention. And no doubt, it's not about abandoning goals. Realize our lives. Not at all. This is a really wrong understanding. If we are it in this way. So we continue to have goals, but they exist in a larger context of meaning that offers the possibility beyond the fluctuations of getting what it's about. That we can be in balance and in peace. Really nice little autobiography of intention. It's quite nice the way that it goes. Walk down the street, there's a deep hole in the sidewalk. Fall in, I'm lost, I'm hopeless. It isn't my fault. It takes forever to find a way out. Chapter. I walk down the same street, there's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in again. I can't believe I'm in the same place. But it isn't my fault. It still takes a long time to get out. Third chapter. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see. I still fall in. It's a habit. My eyes are open. I know where I am. It is my fault. I get out immediately. The fourth chapter. I walk down the same street in the sidewalk. I walk around. Fifth chapter, which is another. That's how the path goes. So you see, from confusion to clarity, this is really what is happening. And it's so great that it is this way. So this is the can help us meet whatever comes up in life. And what is so extraordinary is that we can have a lot of in relationship to the ease and the joy that comes up when we are connecting to the truth. Because each step that we're making is a new step. It's a discovery. It's not some yet another walking through. One more breath to look at. Place. New moment. You've never walked in this garden outside. You just arrived. Everything's new. It's extraordinary. It's possible. Another attitude. It's not going to be another garden. It's not going to be any different, except that we see it differently. As Marcel Proust says, it's not about new landscape, it's about having. And with new eyes, we discover the world from a perspective which is so joyful, so happy, and we can appreciate it in the way that you've done some appreciation practice this afternoon with Sue. That quality, a very beautiful simplicity of connection. Being a human being is not easy. But if we struggle even more because we have a wrong attitude in relationship to putting an overweight, when we can live much more lightly, definitely doesn't mean we don't have ups and downs, difficulties. Sometimes it's very hard. There's no doubt. It is a challenge. Yet, the way that we meet our challenges really gives an opportunity to be sensitized and humbled, actually. We're humbled. Because of this quality in our meditation, there's a sense of investigation. And I'm just going to say a few words because I think there was a little bit of unclarity in relationship to this investigation. Investigation maybe isn't exactly interested, so interested in the momentary experience, that living experience that is always manifesting in one way or another, which is an ongoing life. And so there's here not in any way, when there is this sense of investigation and interest, curiosity, a preconceived idea about how, which means that there's a really great sense then of openness. And the quality that comes from that is trust. Is always waiting for something better. Trust is trusting the unknown. And we definitely don't know. Even if we try to control, we try to have it improve, and this is exactly what we've been talking about, do things in a way. Yet, from that place of intention, gives an openness known. So this is the kind of investigation. Just quote Jack Kornfield in relationship to this. He says, in Seeking the Heart of Wisdom, he says, "The quality of investigation requires courage. It is an acknowledgement that we don't really know, and a willingness to examine the deeper questions." Don Juan explains that only by being a spiritual warrior can one withstand the path of wisdom. And while for ordinary people lies a series of blessings, and for the one who wishes to become a man or woman of wisdom, life and practice is one continuous. The spirit of investigation allows us to look into and be with whatever. So what can help? What is the support? Well, the practice developing here definitely helps. And there's no, when there's a totality of that being, the energy is not so dispersed. There's a real intimacy in the very clear way that Charles talked about. We're here, and we're allowing and surrendering, in a way, into whatever happens. It can happen, it can be received. Awareness can be aware of anything. Not an it. It's not a thing, right? So, in an experiential way, in the way that we, the mind or heart, in the direction of when we're content with awareness, we can be really trusting it, rather than look for certain experiences and avoid other experiences. That's the end of this talk, and the poem is from Helen Keller. It says, "Security is mostly a superstition. It does not exist in nature. Nor do the children of men as a whole experience. Avoiding danger is no safer in the long run than outright exposure. And behave like free spirits in the presence of fate is strength undefeated."